From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The story dominating the news this week was the legal wrangling over the feeding tube that sustains the life of Terri Schiavo. The medical consensus is that she's existed for 15 years in a persistent vegetative state. After a series of court battles nearly as long, and the intervention of Congress and the president intended to clear the way for more appeals, the legal consensus is that her husband should be the one to decide whether to remove that lifeline. Much of the coverage served up an image of a nation sharply and more or less evenly divided.
Demonstrators here at the hospice where I'm standing, they have been increasingly more and more passionate as Terri Schiavo has become more and more dehydrated, and they are passionately arguing their positions.
I think that the radical right has hijacked this issue and exploited this woman.
Let's be honest here. You have a woman behind us who is being starved to death and dehydrated.
Tape like that and the abundant coverage of protests offered a range of views, but it also presented a misleading picture of where the public stood, choosing in many cases the appearance of balance over accuracy. And this bothered Eric Bowler, who's been watching the polls and covering the coverage for Salon.com.
Well, I think originally when the story first became national a week ago Friday, I looked at the coverage Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the television coverage, virtually no mention of polls. And there were very recent polls at that point by ABC and Fox, which clearly showed that a majority thought it was up to the spouse and not the parents to decide. On Monday, ABC released a poll right after the action by Congress and the president showed even more people were upset that Congress and the president got involved. Again, Monday, ABC released that poll. Monday night, World News with Peter Jennings didn't even report on its own poll. But as the week progressed, I think there was more mention of it. CBS released a poll on Wednesday that was even more lopsided than ABC's poll. But again, in general, I think there's been an enormous lack of context, and I think there's been an incredible lack of curiosity. And I think the reporters have done a very poor job in passing that context along to the readers and viewers.
So you think that this is a controversy that's being pumped up for TV?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a great story for TV. I think people would pay attention. But I think what's being pumped up is that this is sort of a red state, blue state, and people are really at odds over this issue. They're not. The press has left that context out.
Now, let's talk for a moment about those few seconds of video that anybody with a TV is bound to see eventually. It shows Terri Schiavo looking up with what seems to be a delighted smile at her mother and following the action with her eyes. It's really heartbreaking.
TV has to have a great image, and those are very compelling images. What people don't realize is there's about 6 hours of those videos from, I think, 2001. You know, we see about 90 seconds. The Schindler family has put out what are clearly highly selective videos in order to create this impression that with the right care, Terri Schiavo could come out of this tape. Judge Greer and others watched all 6 hours and all the scores of doctors. No doctor who has looked at those tapes has come to the same conclusion.
Also, it was part of the evidence that was presented by Terri Schiavo's parents, and it wasn't always identified as such.
No, right. And, you know, I guarantee if Michael Schiavo wanted to, he could release very painful pictures of Terri Schiavo that showed her in a complete vegetative state. But, you know, he doesn't want to do that, and I think good for him. But again, there's not a lot of context in these images that have become almost nonstop on the cable TV screen.
How has the newspaper coverage differed from the TV coverage?
I find the same problem. I mean, I looked that first weekend of the coverage. LA Times did 10 stories from Friday till Monday. Not one story mentioned a poll result about how Americans have felt about this specific issue. Washington Times, New York Times, that first weekend of the coverage, all of them did nearly a dozen stories about the specific case, and not once did they inform readers, by the way, 60-70% of Americans side with Michael Schiavo in this controversy.
On Thursday, you saw a little more poll coverage.
A little, but not very much. And the CBS poll, which was released on Wednesday afternoon, that got very little coverage in terms of the mainstream press. I hate to fall back to, you know, on what if Clinton had been in office, but if Bill Clinton had cut his vacation short to come back to sign emergency legislation at midnight, and then 2 days later, two network polls showed that 70-80% of Americans opposed that action, if not the entire coverage, a strong subcurrent of that coverage would have been, how was the White House going to rebound from this debacle?
You made a kind of a weird connection in one of your stories this week, likening the coverage of the Schiavo case to Monica Gate and the Clinton impeachment.
Well, I was struck particularly by watching the reaction of the conservative columnists and the conservative pundits. And I drew the parallel that during the impeachment years, the more and more upset and agitated and emotional they got about the issue, the further and further away they drifted from the mainstream public opinion based on polls. And I think we've seen that this week. You know, if you turn on MSNBC, if you watch Joe Scarborough, I mean, he and his entire lineup of guests will say the same thing. You know, what is wrong with this country? How can this be happening? As if, you know, a feeding tube had never been disconnected. And then they turn on CBS and they have to look at a poll that says 82% of Americans think Congress and the president are wrong to get involved. They don't recognize the country they're living in.
Okay, Eric, obviously you are a liberal. Is this just a question of the liberal perspective being underreported? Because even if you suggest an out of touch with the mainstream American right wing of the Republican Party has in fact commandeered this debate in Congress, are you saying that the media are showing a right wing bias too?
Well, yeah, I think they're spooked and they continue to be spooked about this charge about being liberal, about being out of touch, about being anti-religion. That's sort of the latest accusation that's been made in the last 6 or 9 months. So, yeah, I think they are consciously afraid of pointing out the obvious. Even if it's the 14th paragraph in a 20-graph piece in the New York Times, there should be a sentence that says 82% of Americans disagree on what Congress and the president did. That includes 64% of white evangelicals. Just put it in the story. Let people make up their own minds.
All right, Eric, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Bollard has been covering the coverage of the Schiavo story for Salon.com.
There aren't a lot of companies who can claim the number of fan newsletters, fan chat rooms, and fan websites that Apple Computer can. Last year, a few of those sites offered leaked details about a soon-to-be-released Apple device. Apple responded with a lawsuit for the alleged leakers and a subpoena for the bloggers who posted the details. The bloggers said that California's so-called Shield Law exempted them from having to divulge their sources. Suddenly, the Internet was abuzz with speculation about whether the judge would agree, setting a precedent for treating bloggers as real journalists. In the end, the judge sidestepped the issue, ruling this month that the leaks clearly involved trade secrets and that no journalist, online or otherwise, has the right to shield that kind of leaker. Joining us now is Susan Crawford, professor of Internet Law at Cardozo Law School. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Bob. It's great to be here.
It's very easy to invoke any business information as a trade secret. I know myself from grim experience that you call Procter & Gamble and ask how's the weather in Cincinnati, and they say, I'm sorry, Bob, that's proprietary.
Well, it's funny you should mention Procter & Gamble, because 15 years ago, they came under a lot of public scrutiny for claiming that information that had been leaked to a reporter was trade secret information and that they would have to go after the reporter's phone records. They came under so much scrutiny that they backed off. It's very true that anything can be a trade secret. The barriers are alarmingly low.
And is there any mechanism outside of a lawsuit for determining whether something is legitimately called a trade secret?
No, that's the problem. A court has to determine whether the company took adequate measures to protect the secrecy of whatever fact is at issue and has to figure out whether a confidential relationship was breached. So it's difficult to determine the strength of a claim of trade secret without a court getting involved.
And yet there is a long history of traditional media going to some lengths to publish trade secrets. I mean, I'm thinking of the automotive press and the glee with which they take automotive prototypes, they find pictures of them on proving grounds around the world, and then they publish them in their magazines. Has litigation ever flowed from that kind of scoop?
No, companies rarely litigate because they depend on the media. They don't want to be seen as ogres suing the reporters who are, in fact, making their name.
The judge wrote that unlike government whistleblowers disclosing serious threats to the public safety, for example, the bloggers, quote, are doing nothing more than feeding the public's insatiable desire for information. Well, it's an odd observation because, Susan, isn't the journalist's job more or less to feed the public's desire for information?
That's exactly right. This judge doesn't see the online world as a serious civic forum, which, in fact, is what it's become. And so he says, this isn't journalism. I think of journalism as an institution telling me what the facts are. This is something much more casual that doesn't deserve protection. So the judge sees a very serious trade secret on one side, and on the other side, he sees a bunch of people in pajamas eating noodles, and he can't take those people seriously.
Isn't this a bit of a slippery slope when a judge is determining what constitutes newsworthiness and what does not?
Well, that's a slope that judges go down all the time in many different contexts. So I don't see that as a slippery slope in this particular instance. In this case, we have a very serious trade secret, you know, a new piece of machinery that they're about to release, the identity of which, if known to their competitors, could give their competitors a head start on developing something that would knock out their market. If you read this decision as limited to its facts, the sky is not falling, not a big deal. If you read the decision as saying any trade secret trumps the First Amendment and the reporter's privilege, then we're in big trouble. I think the larger trend, the thing we have to be concerned about, is the increasing propertization of American society and the increasing secrecy with which government and companies do their business. So my fear is that this case be read as something much broader than what it is, which standing by itself is a reasonable decision about a key Apple trade secret.
All right, Susan, maybe the slope isn't slippery, but let's take a walk up it if we can. There was a subsidiary of Halliburton that was accused of overcharging for its services in Iraq, and it had apparently withheld some information from UN auditors with the help of the Pentagon, which allowed heavily redacted documents to go to the United Nations. And the rationale was that the information could be, quote, used by a competitor to damage the company's ability to win and negotiate new work. Now, is that a legitimate invocation of a trade secret?
In my mind, no. And that case shows that the First Amendment is being destroyed by this trend of propertization in American law. Halliburton is the government for many purposes in Iraq. What it does should be the object of a reporter's scrutiny. To be able to launder your information through the government's confidential treatment statutes and then come out the other end saying, oh, this is confidential competitive business information, means reporters are completely stuck. They can't write a story that would reveal something important about what our government is doing in Iraq. To me, that's a shameful use of American law.
Okay. Well, Susan, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate it. I enjoyed that.
Susan Crawford teaches internet law at Cardozo Law School in New York. You can read her thoughts on media and law at scrawford.blogware.com.
Coming up, whistleblowers and their discontents.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, Bill Arkin confronted a potentially career-ending accusation. A one-time Army intelligence analyst, Arkin has been for more than 20 years a journalist and crusader for military transparency. He was, for instance, the first to disclose the U.S. military plans for Operation Iraqi Freedom. And most recently, he's published a comprehensive list of code names assigned to U.S. military and intelligence operations. He's continually explored the limits of what the public has a right to know and what the military should keep secret. And so it was especially damning and suspect when a cable sent to Washington Times reporter Bill Gertz offered evidence that Arkin had been a spy for Saddam Hussein. Arkin quickly proved the cable a fake and called for a Defense Department investigation, but questions remain about the cable's origins. Bill, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, describe the chain of events that led you to finding out about this thing.
Well, last Monday, I got a call from Bill Gertz, the defense correspondent for the Washington Times, asking me if I would like to respond to allegations that I had taken money from Saddam Hussein from 1994 to 1998. I said, well, I can't really answer any allegation until I see the document, and he sent it to me. And it certainly looks authentic. Someone has spent a lot of time and energy to create an intelligence report that looks sort of like intelligence reports. But the reality is that there were little things about it that were wrong. Well, there was first a big thing about it that was wrong.
And what was that?
I wasn't an Iraqi spy.
Oh. Not to get too wonky here, you seem to be the absolute worst person to fake a Defense Department intelligence memo about, since you have files of thousands of them and you know exactly how they're supposed to look and what the code names for various periods covered would be. But what was the tip-off that it was a forgery?
It was addressed, for instance, to U.S. CINC-CENT, and that is Commander-in-Chief Central Command. Well, the reality was that at the time that the cable was purportedly written, there was no such thing as a U.S. CINC-CENT. Secretary Rumsfeld had decided that they should all be called commanders of Central Command rather than commanders-in-chief. There's only one commander-in-chief.
And this jumped out at you, did it?
Well, it jumped out at me with 15 other minor things that could bore you to death if I went into them. Overall, the allegations, you know, they were close enough to the truth, and that is an issue with any forgery. It has to be plausible. Yet at the same time, when I looked at the form of the reporting, it appeared to be a forgery, which, by the way, the Defense Department confirmed.
Explain why this was, as you say, somewhat plausible. You were in Iraq at one point as a consultant to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Now, the forged cable cites this as evidence of your collusion with Saddam. How did it make that link?
I had worked as a consultant for the Secretary General in 1998. I was hired to conduct an investigation whether or not the UN Special Commission was spying on behalf of the United States. I didn't go to Iraq in 1998, something that the cable says I did do. Certainly, the U.S. government was very mad at me in 1998 for exposing the fact that they were using the UN Special Commission to spy on Iraq. And the cable claims that documents were recovered in Baghdad after the Iraq War, which indicated that I was being paid.
This isn't the first time you've been smeared.
No, it's not. I feel like there's sort of two separate issues here. One is former Defense Department officials or former intelligence officials saying that I'm a commie pinko. I kind of wear that these days as a badge of honor. But the fact that there was a document out there that to some untrained observers might have appeared to be authentic really was worrisome to me. Particularly in the electronic age, where documents can be fabricated and circulate so quickly and so easily. And I feel like, given that I just had a new book that came out, this fabricated document might have been the beginnings of, or might be the beginnings of, a campaign to not only intimidate me, but intimidate other journalists.
What advice would you give to those who might consider whistleblowing?
Well, I think whistleblowers are an important element of the democratic process, and they are protected and generally, I think, even revered, particularly when they blow the whistle on boondoggles and expensive wastes of American taxpayer dollars. But I think what is happening now in the Bush administration is that we see sort of three things happening, I think, at the same time. One is this trend towards greater personal attack. Two is a tremendous increase in secrecy, even trivial secrecy, particularly at new departments like the Department of Homeland Security. And then three, I think, is the dilution of the protection of federal employees who might step forward to speak about improprieties.
All right. Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Bill Arkin is a military analyst for NBC News and the author most recently of Code Names, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World.
Whistleblowers are one of the best checks the public has on corruption, incompetence, and cover-up in government. That's why there are laws protecting federal whistleblowers. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel, an independent body, is supposed to protect federal whistleblowers by processing the requests for investigation and shielding them from retaliation. In other words, if you leak in the public interest and get fired, transferred, or docked, this is the place you go. But recently, three national whistleblower organizations themselves tried to blow the whistle on the special counsel. They say that whistleblowers are, quote, meeting a dead end at the office that is supposed to be a whistleblowing advocate. Jeff Ruck is executive director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, one of the three concerned watchdog groups. He joins me now. Jeff, welcome to OTM.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're quoted in the press release saying about the special counsel in charge of the office, Scott Block is running the shabbiest closeout sale in the history of the Whistleblower Protection Act. Now, those are strong words.
I said that in connection with the disclosure by his office that was inadvertent that they had dismissed 1,000 whistleblower cases during his tenure without investigation. And the spokesperson for the special counsel said that all of those cases were dismissed without any further referral or investigation because all of the matters they raised were trivial or stale. He's not represented a single whistleblower. In many cases where they're asking for investigation, they have no other recourse. Scott Block, the Office of Special Counsel, is the last word. We've likened it to discovering that your new fire chief is the town arsonist.
What about new whistleblowers coming forward? Is there any evidence so far that the current state of affairs has had a chilling effect, that it's discouraged people from blowing the whistle on their own federal bureaucracies?
Well, two things about that. One is that this special counsel has been notable for his refusal to release any information. So, for example, we found out about the cases being dismissed because he referred to them in a letter to Representative Henry Waxman. He's yet to issue any reports or respond to requests for information. So all we have is anecdotal evidence. We know that we're not referring additional people to the Office of Special Counsel. Mr. Block used to be the deputy director of the Justice Department Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, and so we're telling whistleblowers that you better have faith because you may not have much hope.
The whole idea of special counsels is they're supposed to be independent of the machinery, certainly of politics. Is Scott Block an independent agent, or is this a case of the fox guarding the hen house?
Maybe a maniac overseeing the asylum. We're not quite sure what the method to his madness is, but he's conducted a purge inside of his own agency to root out what he calls, quote-unquote, leakers. So a number of special counsel attorneys and investigators have been put on paid administrative leave, relieved of all their duties. And the reason was they refused orders to relocate to Detroit to open a new Midwestern field office. It's been a horrendous disruption as part of a whole series of what appeared to be perverse personnel moves by the special counsel.
What motives do you ascribe to him?
We think that Scott Block is politicizing the office. So what he's doing is pushing out the veteran civil servants and replacing them with selected loyalists who all appear to be movement conservatives. So, for example, he's hired three brand-new graduates from the ultra-conservative Ave Maria Law School to act as investigators and attorneys rather than, as traditionally was done, have a competitive examination so that attorneys from around the country could compete for these positions. He's not made a single hire on a competitive basis.
Obviously, the Congress did not legislate the Whistleblower Protection Act for no reason. They had an interest in protecting whistleblowers and historically have not looked on to kindly when administrations try to subvert the laws that it has passed. Is there any uproar in Congress about this situation?
There is. The Senate Government Affairs Committee has announced they're going to hold an investigative hearing. Members of the House have asked for the Government Accountability Office to do an investigation. And other members of Congress have called for Scott Block's resignation. But the key committees that hold gavels are of the president's party, and I think that there's been a very deep concern about doing anything that embarrasses the administration, which is one of the reasons why the independent functioning of the special counsel is now more critical than ever, because a lot of the traditional avenues of oversight are closed or closing.
Politically, the Congress is in such lockstep with the administration that they're not going to protect against the executive branch usurping its oversight authority?
This is certainly not the golden age of congressional oversight, and we joke that the only way to get Congress to hear this is to start a rumor that Scott Block's on steroids, and maybe that stimulated him.
All right, Jeff. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Jeff Ruck is Executive Director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. Scott Block is, as you know by now, the U.S. Special Counsel. He was nominated by President Bush and sworn into the office in January 2004. He says the office had a chronic backlog that crippled the agency's ability to provide full, fair, and expeditious justice to whistleblowers. He says he has not been throwing whistleblower cases away, but rather changing the system to make it more efficient. Scott Block, welcome to On the Media.
It's a pleasure to be here, Bob.
Specifically with respect to whistleblowers, how did your procedures change?
I asked the whistleblower unit to come up with creative solutions to how to deal with the large influx of claims and the old claims that were sitting on the shelf gathering dust, while at the same time having no new staff, and in fact having suffered some loss of staff. The solution that we came up with in the special projects unit was, again, to bring in other attorneys who worked in other units. They swept through the unit and were able to bring a fresh perspective, a certain amount of energy, and this had tremendous benefits. In addition to that, we hired some summer interns who worked under the supervision of attorneys to make the initial calls to whistleblowers to find out if they still worked at the agency, to basically perform a certain customer service function, and sometimes to do legal research.
And how many of those cases found their way through this new procedure to be referred to other agencies for further investigation?
Well, I can't give you an exact number. I can only tell you that we doubled the number of referrals to the agencies finding substantiated whistleblower claims over the prior year. How many exactly came out of the special projects unit process, I can't tell you. I know there were some.
I mean, was it greater than 3, for example? Was it
greater
than 50?
No, it was not greater than 50, but it was greater than 3.
What was the basic threshold for determining whether to refer?
We are asked to determine if there is a substantial likelihood as to whether the condition or the illegality occurred. The standard that we used for determining what substantial likelihood meant varied from year to year and from special counsel to special counsel. We believed, as a result of our study of the process, that the standard we were using to determine whether a substantial likelihood existed was higher than what the agency itself would use when it did a full investigation. We, of course, are not empowered by Congress to do any investigation of the whistleblower complaint. All we're entitled to do is review the file. But I think the important message to get across, Bob, is that whistleblowers have seen a greater success with our agency while I've been here than has been enjoyed in the past under a more stringent standard, and we think this is all for the good.
One of the things that has raised eyebrows is how you have staffed the agency. Someone complained that, for example, you bypassed ordinary civil service hiring procedures of lawyers to go to the Ave Maria Law School, founded by Tom Monahan, the Domino's Pizza Baron, explicitly with a conservative ideology, and that the lawyers that come out of Ave Maria almost by definition are true believers.
No, that's completely false. Our office has hired people using the proper civil service laws, rules, and regulations. We have violated none. We have returned to a practice of one of my predecessor special counsels that in the area of exempted service or accepted service hires, that is attorneys, they are Schedule A hire, we have used, not always, but we have used the right to hire in people directly who have been recommended through the Justice Department or other places as excellent candidates. So this is really a baseless allegation.
If 3 people from a small law school with an ideological bent show up in one agency, that's a reason to at least ask a question. And that's what I'm doing. I'm asking the question.
We just know that we've hired highly qualified individuals who came well recommended, were unknown to me as people, not hired based on any other criteria except their abilities. And if you want to talk to others outside of my office who have some knowledge about these ideological issues that don't really concern us, you're free to do that, but I don't share your presumptions.
Well, as you know, we're not speaking to you about this for no reason. We just got off with Jeff Ruck, who thinks that maybe the maniacs are running the asylum and that the White House expects you not to protect whistleblowers, but just to shut them up. What were your marching orders when you took the job?
Well, Bob, sometimes I wonder if you have to fall through the rabbit hole to live in Washington. Things seem to be turned on their head in the media. We deal in rumor, innuendo, and special interests, throwing around name-calling and pretending it's the truth. The truth is, I took an oath of office to defend whistleblowers and to take the meritorious claims and push them to the limit. And that's exactly what we're doing. Now, I cannot help it if individuals want to gainsay that or throw around reckless allegations, but they're false. I have no marching orders, and I don't take marching orders. We are an independent federal agency that is dedicated to supporting the merit system and protecting whistleblowers and to improving government efficiency and integrity. And that's what we're doing.
Scott Block is the U.S. Special Counsel.
And now an update on the investigation of the Bush administration's most notorious leak, that of the name of CIA official Valerie Plame. Plame, you'll recall, is the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who cast doubt on White House assertions about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to war. His wife's CIA connection was leaked, apparently, in retaliation by a White House official. But we don't know who. The investigators do know the names of the reporters who received the leak, and that's why Judith Miller of the New York Times and Matt Cooper of Time Magazine are headed to jail. They won't reveal the leaker, who investigators say committed a crime.
Legal appeals on First Amendment grounds have failed. This week, 36 news organizations, ranging from Hearst Newspapers to the Associated Press, filed a friend of the court brief with a whole new tack, suggesting that, in fact, no crime has been committed. Lawyer Bruce Sanford, who filed the brief, helped to write the statute on which the investigation is based, the Intelligence Protection Act of 1982. He's asserted that his statute was never intended to prosecute journalists in situations like this. Moreover, he contends, Plame's service at the time of the leak does not meet the standard for secrecy covered by the law. No crime, no case. Interesting strategy. Watch this space.
Coming up, Air America turns one. And will the real liberal Limbaugh please stand up?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org, the Melville Charitable Trust Foundation, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 1 year ago this week, a motley assortment of stand-up comedians, political activists, and millionaire investors came together on Park Avenue in New York City to create an angry, in-your-face talk radio network. On March 31st, 2004, with Democratic drumbeater Al Franken behind the microphone, the openly abrasive, unabashedly liberal Air America was born.
From an underground bunker 3,500 feet below Dick Cheney's bunker, Air America Radio is on the air.
The network was advertised as the antidote to just about everything else on the AM dial, which has for years been a stronghold of conservative opinion. And so, with the midwife still lingering in the room, predictions of a great demise for Air America came gleefully from the right, including this assessment by Republican talk show host Sean Hannity.
Here's a hint. These people are not bright. Here's a hint. They really are dull.
Air America is at times sophomoric and dull, but it can also be witty and scathing. One reason it has survived its first turbulent year of staff shakeups and near economic collapse, all captured on hundreds of hours of tape and distilled into the new HBO documentary, Left of the Dial. Filmmaker Patrick Farrelly joins me here in our studio. Welcome to On the Media.
Thanks.
So, Patrick, there have been scores of media startups every year, and you chose to follow Air America. In your mind, did the inherent riskiness of this venture guarantee that there'd be a dramatic story to tell?
To be quite honest, it really didn't. And we had nothing like that in mind, as I'm sure the people who were involved in Air America had no idea what was going to happen. The reason we were interested in it was the political year of last year, which was very energetic, a very divided country, hot political debates, and the fact that people were trying to launch the first commercial liberal progressive radio network in that context was what actually interested us.
So you were drawn by the political venture rather than the business venture?
Yeah, we were drawn by the politics of it, but also we were interested in how you actually launch a radio network, which is, you know, as anyone can tell you, it's not an easy business. And we were also interested to see whether it was possible for these people to essentially achieve what they were setting out to do, which is to sort of change the national conversation.
And the way that you depict those early weeks, there were technical glitches, there were prickly and occasionally hysterical hosts, frequently unprepared hosts, logistical problems, and then a monumental cash shortfall. What happened?
In essence, what happened is that the rug was pulled from under them just as they kind of were beginning to hit their stride. The real mover behind this incredibly energetic guy, a fellow by the name of Evan Cohen, who was the chairman of the board of Air America Radio and allegedly its chief investor. There came a certain point when, literally, as they say, after 1 month on the air, they lost their Chicago station, they lost their LA affiliate, and they only had four affiliates at that point.
Right.
So this was a huge, huge blow. The company that owned those two affiliates said that they, in fact, had bounced the checks, the money that was needed to pay for the lease. Air America energetically denied that. But as it turned out, they, in fact, had bounced the checks.
And not just those checks, also paychecks, and you had lapsed health insurance, you had general panic ensuing. And I guess the problem was that Evan Cohen had apparently misled the staff about how much startup cash he actually had in hand. Is that a fair read?
I think that's a fair read of the situation. I mean, I think that in essence, I mean, Evan Cohen to me is a kind of almost a quintessential American character. Without him, Air America Radio could never have happened because he was the guy who actually dragged the whole thing together. You know, I think he was giving people the impression that he had personally put millions of dollars into the company and that he was able to draw on millions of dollars. And it turned out that 1 month after the launch, there was no money left.
And when the money ran out, Cohen jumped ship. And we have some tape from your film where he casts himself as a victim of sorts.
Well, obviously, Jesus, I pumped millions of dollars into it. I, you know, did everything I could. You know, but hey, early on when it was beautiful and everybody got what they wanted, they were hiring their friends and, you know, all sorts of great things, you know, people were happy. But, you know, hit a glitch quickly. How quickly goodwill rolls away.
I think at that point, Evan Cohen was in denial. I mean, ultimately, the guy is a salesman. He's never going to say that, in fact, you know, that he sold people a bill of goods. Among the staff, there was this intense sense of betrayal. The fact that in the movie you see, for example, Evan Cohen arrives late at night to sign over the company so they can actually bring in new investors is because I think that if he arrived during the day, he would have run into a very, very hostile staff in a very, very difficult situation. And he basically, you know, he just disappeared off the scene.
And after Cohen left, new investors weren't exactly lining up. Did that surprise you?
That kind of surprised me because, you know, there really wasn't all that big liberal money out there. When people talk about the media in this country and all the liberals and so on and so forth, I mean, at that point, it wouldn't have taken an enormous amount of money to actually keep Air America Radio on the road. And you would have thought that, particularly at a time when we're talking about last May and June, when, you know, the political season is really hotting up, there's an awful lot of stuff at stake politically, that people would be coming in to bail them out.
It seems that part of the mismanagement of Air America, if there was mismanagement, involves the way it promoted its star talent. Al Franken and Janine Garofalo were, in every single article, the sole person on the on-air staff who had real radio experience and a proven track record for drawing audience, even outdrawing Rush Limbaugh in Florida, was Randy Rose.
But Scott McClellan today, who replaced Ari Fleischer, who replaced Karen Hughes, because how many days can you go to work and lie your ass off for a living? He said, quote, you know, every step of the way in Iraq, there have been pessimists and hand-wringers who say it can't be done. It turns out that there is a reason for that, Scott. It can't be done! That's the reason!
I think it was a big mistake them not actually promoting Randy with whatever resources they had, because she's a very magnetic character, very, very provocative. When their first Arbitron ratings come in, as you know, these happen over a three-month period, particularly Randy did very, very well. And that was all, as Doug Krieger, who was acting CEO at the time, said, it was all in spite of bad publicity, because whenever you read about Air America, it was Air America Radio, comma, the financially strapped, crisis-ridden, etc. So I think in terms of how they actually managed to stay alive, I think was a pretty extraordinary achievement in and of itself.
And where does Air America stand now?
Well, you know, 1 year after they were launched, they now have 50 affiliates. They're covering something like 60% of the country. And I think that, you know, in an odd way, the person who's responsible for that surge in growth is George W. Bush. The fact of George Bush being reelected is probably the best prescription in terms of a business plan for Air America Radio for the next 4 years, because you still have a bitterly divided country. You still have a large section of the population who is quite happy to sit down and listen to every bad thing you can think of to say about George W. Bush and the Bush administration.
Patrick Farrelly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick Farrelly is the director and producer with Kate O'Callaghan of the documentary Left of the Dial, which premieres on HBO on March 31st. Danny Goldberg, a music industry veteran and founder of Artemis Records, took over as CEO of the network just a few weeks ago. He joins us now from his noisy office in Manhattan. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Danny, I got to tell you, the head of Air America seems to fulfill the same function historically as the drummer in Spinal Tap, constantly blowing up.
Well, I think it's a startup company. It's only the one-year anniversary, March 31st, and it's a miracle that it's still in business. It had two false starts, not because of who the CEOs were, but because there were two people that said they were putting up money that didn't put it up.
Air America started on four stations, then there was briefly two stations. Now they're hovering around 50 or so. Where do you see the network heading over the next coming year, and how do you make your predictions?
As of April 1st, we'll be on in 17 of the top 20 markets, reaching about 55% of the population of the United States. And the goal is by the fall to be up around 80%, which I think is very realistic based on the ratings and the attractiveness of the programming to underperforming radio stations, mostly AM radio stations around the country, where their owners prefer to have us on because they can do better business-wise. To really be a credible network, I think we need to get to that 80% mark as soon as possible. And my guess is it'll be around the beginning of the fall that we'll get there.
Some have criticized Air America for not putting enough muscle behind the promotion of Randy Rhodes.
I don't know if people listening realize how limited the staff has been of Air America. Up until now, there has been no in-house promotion department of any kind. There's been virtually no paid advertising, although we do currently have a campaign in New York that includes all of our on-air talent, including Randy Rhodes. It sort of happened by itself through word of mouth and through what the press chose to cover. Mm-hmm. Al did get a disproportionate amount of attention because he had a celebrity in the general culture. Randy is a superstar within the radio culture, which you're right, for a radio network is every bit as much important, if not more so.
Air America was supposed to produce the liberal Rush Limbaugh. There is a particular way that Limbaugh connects with his audience. Has Air America produced anybody like that?
Well, I think both Al Franken and Randy Rhodes, all of our people are connecting with an audience, an impassioned minority that exists all over the country, and there's a yearning all over the country for an alternative voice.
You come from the music industry. You started a record label. Do you think that you have the tools to manage a big radio company?
I'm not sure that anyone would have the background for Air America Radio because it's a hybrid between a conventional radio network and a cultural brand like an MTV or Rolling Stone. So I've got either the foolishness or the guts to try to do it, and I don't think there's any one person that would have all the different tools. Hopefully I've got enough of them not to screw it up.
Danny Goldberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Danny Goldberg is the CEO of Air America. Now, Air America's business model is very different from that of most conservative talk radio in that it chose to lease airtime in some big markets rather than to grow its carriage gradually. But another liberal talk show host took the more traditional route, eventually picking up dozens of stations without paying for airtime. His name is Ed Schultz. He's a political convert. He used to have a right-wing talk show, and if you're not paying close attention to what he's actually saying, he sounds a lot like the guy Air America said was the man to beat. Here's Rush Limbaugh.
They are liberals, and this is how they have woven their fabric. They don't get their extremism passed and signed into law legislatively. They do it via courts and judges.
Here's Ed Schultz.
This is a power grab by the neocons. This is all about trying to prove to them that they are compassionate, despite the fact that this is the same crowd that last week was talking about cutting Medicare and Medicaid.
Limbaugh?
They are liberals, and this is how they have woven their fabric.
Schultz?
This is a power grab by the neocons.
Is Ed Schultz the Limbaugh of the left? He joins me now from Fargo. Ed, welcome to On the Media.
Brooke, thank you.
First of all, how's your show doing?
Show's doing really well. We started on two stations, Needles, California and Langdon, North Dakota, on January 4th of 04. And 15 months later, we're now in 80 markets and 8 out of the top 10. It's really the fastest growing show since Limbaugh got going.
And to what do you attribute that?
It's very little to do with politics if a show is going to be successful. Only 10% of the people that come to a radio show do it for political gratification. They've got to have entertainment, relevant information, got to be able to communicate, caller interaction. You got to have pace. You have to move the show. Program directors and general managers don't say, hey, here's Ed Schultz. He's a progressive. Let's put him on the air. I mean, if it doesn't sound good, if it doesn't have the qualities of a good radio show, it's not going to go anywhere.
Now, we've had you on the show before talking about your political conversion. I know some people have suggested that this was self-interested. Why did you switch?
You know, when I went into a homeless clinic in 1998, the one that my wife managed in Fargo, I met Vietnam veterans and started asking questions. When I saw health care costs that are going through the roof and really the Republicans doing absolutely nothing to turn the tide on that, I finally went on the air one day in about 2001 said, you know what, I am a Democrat. I am a liberal. I cannot align myself with what is happening right now in this neocon, this conservative-driven agenda that is storming Washington.
Now, Ed, Rush Limbaugh is widely credited with helping to usher in the so-called Republican Revolution of 1994. If talk radio has that kind of power, is it fair to say that liberal talk radio just didn't deliver in 2004?
Well, politically speaking, the righties, as I call them, the Limbaughs, he's got a 15, 16-year start on all this. And he's good. He is a professional communicator. And with that, the Republican agenda has nurtured the audio culture of the country. The Democrats are way behind the curve. The Democratic Party is way out of touch. Kerry did as much to defeat himself, in my opinion, as Rush Limbaugh or any conservative talker in this country did to defeat him. The Democrats, the liberals, they got to get in this game. It's called repetitive message. They got to talk to Joe Bierkan. They got to figure out how to talk to middle America. They got to make it simple for them to understand. They got to connect with their values. I've got it figured out. That's why my show is growing. I know how to say I'm a gun-toting, meat-eating lefty and damn proud of it.
And talk radio, I think you'll agree, is by nature, or at least by convention, pretty confrontational. And there's a sort of anger. Some have even said a kind of rage. And it's often been said that liberals just don't know how to rage well.
Passion, rage. You have got to be able to interact and be quick with your facts and your opinions. Two of the most important words in talk radio are you and your, because every listener that goes to the dial says, okay, what's in this for me? What's in this for my family? And am I enjoying what I hear right now? That's what radio listeners are doing. I'm not prepared to be the governor of New York. I don't want to be the governor of New York. I want to be a talk show host. I can't speak for the other people that they've tried to do this in the past.
You're talking about Mario Cuomo's radio program.
Of course. He's not a radio professional. He doesn't understand cume. He doesn't understand quarter hour and how to keep it and how to promo and how to move the show. This is a skill that you have to learn and know how to do. You just can't grab a microphone and say, hey, I'm a liberal. I think I'll do a talk show. It doesn't work that way.
What's your opinion then of Air America?
I have no opinion of Air America. They got their shop, I got mine.
Okay. Back when you were a conservative talk show host, were the callers different?
Oh, don't kid yourself. Lefties can get mean, too.
Ed, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ed Schultz is host of The Ed Schultz Show, Straight Talk from the Heartland.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Wallo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keith is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, with help this week from Rob Christensen. Our interns are Susanna Dillaplane and Nick Gilowitz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist-composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And by Lincoln Center, presenting Sondheim and Lapine's Passion, sponsored by MetLife, telecast on Live from Lincoln Center this Thursday, March 31st on PBS. And the Beidel Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.